Welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. This episode recorded on Friday, the 7th of August, 2020. From the Farmers Weekly news desk, I'm Johan Tasker.
And I'm Farmers Weekly news reporter, Ed Henderson.
On this week's podcast, crime in the countryside at an eight-year high. What is at the top of the shopping list for farm theft and why?
Soil regeneration. How farmers in Scotland are improving their soil health by getting down and dirty in the fields.
We've all the latest prices in our regular market roundup.
And we have a special look at spring barley and winter wheat as a patchy harvest continues.
And there's a glimmer of hope for sheep producers seeking a fair price for wool.
But first, a warehouse containing almost 3,000 tonnes of ammonium nitrate fertiliser is being blamed for a huge explosion which killed more than 130 people and flattened buildings in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The explosion has prompted reminders for UK farmers to store fertiliser safely and correctly. For Lincolnshire farmer Andrew Green, it also brought back vivid memories of the 1974 Flixburgh disaster when a chemical plant explosion killed 28 people and damaged 2,000 properties. Andrew, who was 11 at the time, was in the family farmhouse just half a mile away when the Flixburgh plant went up.
It happened at sort of tea time on the Saturday. I was in the farmhouse at the time and I sort of ran downstairs. The front door had been blown off and I could just, like I say, see the metal going up in the air and the big black cloud, you know. I didn't know what it is. I thought it was really like a petrol tanker exploding or a plane crashing, but, you know, when I ran outside, I could sort of see what was happening. So it's a huge impact on the village and the local community, and obviously on the families of all the people who lost their lives.
The Agricultural Industries Confederation said its deepest sympathies went out to those affected by the Beirut blast. Joe Gilbertson is AIC Head of Fertiliser, which represents UK fertiliser manufacturers, distributors and suppliers.
This product is stable, it's non-flammable and non-explosive if it's handled correctly. But it would appear that for whatever reason, something very, very desperately wrong happened in Lebanon. And as we can see from the news reports, the consequences are tragic.
And from a UK perspective, Joe, how should ammonium nitrate fertiliser be stored on farm?
The simplest way of approaching this is to look at the label, and obviously the products that are of the most significant risk are those with an oxidising symbol on them, which should be clearly identifiable. Those should be stored separately and away from any other source of potential fuel in the event of a fire. So we're talking straw, seed, fuel, or even other chemicals and fertilisers such as urea.
There is also the suggestion that the ammonium nitrate in Beirut had been there a number of years. Is there a limit on the length of time it can be safely stored?
There isn't. You're quite right. The product in question would appear to have been in store for possibly as long as 7 years. Our recommendation is always sort of first in, first out. So good stock rotation is really important. The fertiliser that's on sale in the UK and in fact in the European market is subject to very strict safety regulations. Those include special testing of its stability before it even leaves the factory. You know, providing the product is stored carefully and away from flammable products, and you use your stock on a first-in, first-out basis, you should be all right. If you're ever in any doubt, contact your supplier.
What's your response to that, Johan? We're unlikely to see that level of devastation over here, but, you know, it's a stark reminder.
You know, when I saw the Beirut blast on the television, I just couldn't believe it. You know, there's the initial blast, there's a secondary blast, then you see the shockwave. I mean, it is absolutely massive. And the reason that we included that interview with Lincolnshire farmer Andrew Green, who witnessed the Flixburgh disaster in 1974, the reason we included that is because that blast in this country led to changes in health and safety legislation that we benefit from today. And it's thanks to changes in that kind of legislation that we don't see those sorts of disasters in this country. But like you say, it's a timely reminder to keep fertiliser safely stored and don't take it for granted.
Absolutely. And obviously our thoughts are with everyone affected over in Beirut. And I suppose it's a stark reminder, you know, having just had Farm Safety Week, of the importance of farmers taking this seriously.
And just for the avoidance of doubt, Flixborough was not an ammonium nitrate explosion. It was a chemical plant explosion. But, you know, we're all familiar in the agricultural industry with ammonium nitrate. And the danger is that while it does bring lots of benefits, the danger is that we take it for granted. And as Joe Gilbertson was saying, you know, it is a safe product as long as it's stored correctly, as long as it's handled correctly. So if you have any doubts in what you're doing, contact the Health and Safety Executive, contact the AOSC, and they will put you right.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Hi, it's John here from KWS. Drilling is always a chaotic time, so we need to manage our workloads. After last autumn, many will want to crack on and get the seed in the ground, regardless of the agronomist's warnings about blank grass. That's fine, but be aware many of our current varieties are better suited to an October drilling than mid-September. Think about standing ability and speed of movement. A mild autumn and these crops could be thick and require a lot more looking after in the spring. This is where short, stiff, early drill, early harvest KWS Parkin comes in. In earlier sown trials, its true yield potential is realised and the variety significantly outperforms well-known barn fillers. KWS Parkin is a great choice for growers that are looking for something different. And this season, if you're looking to get quickly out the blocks, then it should be the first wheat you put in your drill.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now the latest rural crime figures are out and they make grim reading. Crime in the countryside is at an eight-year high, costing UK farmers a whopping £54 million, 9% more than last year. Somerset farmer Richard Wilcox has had two quad bikes stolen in the past 12 months, and he believes the same gang is behind the thefts.
I personally think it's the same gang that's come back into the same area again and obviously going back to the same haunts, knowing that there's a good chance there's some good pickings there, and I think that's difficult.
Suffolk farmer Glenn Buckingham has been repeatedly targeted too, with GPS equipment worth £10,000 ripped from a combine harvester just before harvest.
There's been several incidents across the county and into Norfolk and Essex. It makes you suspicious of anybody you see in the vicinity of your farm, which is not nice because most people are genuine and honest. But you are starting to think about who's that? What's that? What's going on there? What's that vehicle? You know, who parked here? Why are there wheel marks in my gateway?
PC John Chandler of Norfolk Police said the problem was becoming more widespread.
It's across the county and that's across manufacturers as well. Previously that would have been dominated by the John Deere Starfires, but now we tend to see Trimbles and Topcons and all sorts go from tractors.
The situation's so bad in many places that Jude McGann of the Farming Community Network charity says the crime wave is taking its toll on farmers' mental health and well-being.
Farmers are severely impacted by rural crime and unfortunately increasingly so. This has an impact not just on the farm business but also sort of the health and well-being of the farmers and the farming community. I would encourage farmers to seek help, reach out to organisations like FCN or the Farming Help Organisations. You know, we're here to listen, we're here to support people through whatever the challenges is. You know, even just having someone to talk through the issues and to maybe identify some sort of local sources of support or initiatives that they could get involved in to help protect their farm business or their farm machinery, we will do what we can to get that local contact, local support if possible.
The crime report was compiled by rural insurers NFU Mutual, and we asked the company's Rebecca Davidson to explain the facts behind the figures.
The main driver behind this rise in the cost is organised criminal gangs targeting farms for high-value machinery and also livestock.
One of the things that's affected all of our lives this year is the coronavirus pandemic, and I understand that's had an impact on rural crime as well.
For the lockdown, we have seen rural theft drop overall, so that's welcome news. But worryingly, we did see a few trends and spikes. So, for instance, some of the smaller, more portable pieces of kit and quad bikes were getting stolen in large numbers, and some ATVs and gaiters. We suspect that a lot of the car thieves, their usual income streams drop dried up, and so they started turning their focus to the countryside. And also, surprisingly, we saw some spikes in livestock rustling as well. So 10 years ago, we'd rarely see more than a dozen sheep being taken in one go. Now we're regularly getting reports of 50 to 100.
And you know, Rebecca, this is what I find is the saddest thing about this situation. If you're stealing livestock on that kind of scale, you're going to know exactly what you're doing. You're going to have all the right equipment. You're going to have a big lorry. You're probably going to have dogs to round up the sheep. You're going to have connections within the slaughtering industry so you can dispose of the animals and the carcasses. And that means illegal meat into the food chain. So this is not somebody from outside the industry targeting farmers. This is somebody from within the industry, or people from within the industry targeting their fellow producers.
It's a worrying trend, and I think, you know, there was in the East Midlands that was hard hit last year, and there was a successful conviction as well with one of these cases where animals were being slaughtered in the field. So that was welcomed. But as you say, it needs to be quite a professional operation. And one of the other worrying trends, and I don't want to alarm people, you know, as well, but it has been that working dogs have been targeted as well. Because obviously, if you're taking that sort of number of sheep, you need a really good working dog to help you, particularly when you're rounding them up at night. So it's a worrying trend that we're keeping an eye on.
That's Rebecca Davidson from NFU Mutual. Ed, you've done a lot of work on this subject. It's a problem that just isn't going away. In fact, as the figures show from NFU Mutual, it's actually getting worse.
Yes, and unfortunately, speaking to farmers, clearly the money loss can be devastating, but it's the emotional anguish which is often long-lasting. And a lot of the time, the workplace is also the home for farmers. And I think that the clear message that I've been told is farmers need to report everything. It's really important. If, however trivial, it helps build up a picture of criminality, and hopefully police forces will direct more resources to that area.
And both the farmers that we featured in that clip, Glenn from Suffolk and Richard from Somerset, they painted a very bleak picture of what it's like to be repeatedly targeted by these criminal gangs.
Exactly. And the other thing is, you know, farmers are doing their best to engage with the public. And in situations like that, it's difficult for him because he wants to protect his land and his livestock. And you know, it's difficult to not feel suspicious. And I do feel for those farmers. I really do.
I mean, part of me feels sorry for the police as well, because, you know, they're trying to do a good job. The countryside's a big place. There aren't many of them. They're under-resourced. There's always more that they could do, of course. But from a police point of view, they must feel like they're fighting a losing battle.
And I agree with that. I mean, speaking to farmers in South Yorkshire, for example, they feel that the police are just too thinly spread and it is difficult for them. But I mean, I do think a more joined up approach can work. You know, if police are working with these rural task forces, I mean, I wrote a feature a few weeks ago that showed that more police forces were taking these up. And I think the key to that is cooperation between the farmers and the task force.
Like you say, it's important to get involved and do report those crimes.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Hi, I'm Philip Cosgrave from Yara. For nitrogen applications this autumn on grassland to boost grass supply, then look no further than Yara Bella NutriBooster. This true uniform compound contains nitrate nitrogen for fast, reliable growth, sulfur for yield and grass quality, and selenium for livestock health. For more information on Yara Bella NutriBooster, go to yara.co.uk.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Time for this week's market prices. On the cattle markets, finished steers deadweight R4L price was up 5 pence per kilo to 379.6. Finished steers, the deadweight all average price was up 4 pence to 366.5 pence per kilo. Finished steers, the live weight all average price was 203.5 pence per kilo, virtually unchanged on the week. Finished heifers, the live weight all average price was down 9 pence to 210.2p per kilo. Finished young bulls, the live weight price was down 13 pence to 193.6. Continental cross bull calves are up £8 on the week to £233 per head. Frisian cross bull calves were down £12 to £49 per head. And dairy cows, pounds per head, down £87 to £1297. On the sheep market, the new season lamb price, R3L, was 479.2 pence per kilo. That's up 2p per kilo
on the week. Pigs, cull sows live weight price, 45.1 pence per kilo. The SPPGB deadweight price was 164.7 pence per kilo. That's down about half a pence. The APPGB deadweight price was 168.1 pence per kilo. On the arable markets, feed wheat is fetching £157.60 per tonne, milling wheat 181.4, feed barley 120.2, oilseed rape 326.8, feed peas 192, and feed beans £200 per tonne, ex-farm spot price. Now, as a challenging harvest continues, we have a special report from Farmers Weekly Deputy Arable Editor David Jones. David, you've been looking at the spring barley and winter wheat harvests.
Yes, the spring barley harvest has kicked off over the last few days. With yields and quality variable, we're seeing that crops across southern England on the chalky downlands of Hampshire, Dorset and Wiltshire are showing some good yields and low nitrogen contents after seeing some rain in April and May. Whereas those early crops in East Anglia with little spring rain have seen yields down and high nitrogens as the yield has not been high enough to dilute the nitrogen in the grain. I've been talking to some farmers in southern England, in Dorset and Wiltshire and Hampshire, and they're showing yields of 7 to 8 tonnes a hectare on the spring malting barleys with some no nitrogen, so they're quite happy. And this sort of divided picture has rather reflected the pattern from the earlier winter barley harvest when crops in southern England showed good yields again and nitrogen's largely below 1.65, which the maltsters look for. So altogether this season is likely to be quite a difficult one for the barley, as coronavirus is likely to have cut maltsters' needs from about 1.9 million tonnes per year to about 1.6 million tonnes. So with a big spring barley crop, there is likely to be plenty of barley around, and traders are predicting a similar crop overall to last year at about 8 million tonnes. So the result of that has been plenty of barley around, and the discount of feed barley to feed wheat is now reaching around about £35 a tonne, which has not been hit for a long time.
You've also been looking at the winter wheat harvest.
Yeah, the winter wheat's going fairly well across southern and eastern England. Again, you know, the weather is having a big impact, the weather, the wet autumn and then the droughty spring. So we're seeing yields lower, but quality reasonably good. I think as farmers move on to heavier soils, they're seeing the wheat yields come up a little bit. Nothing like last year, but there is a little bit more optimism about the crop. I mean, traders are looking at a lower area and the weather problems, so they're predicting an overall wheat crop which is going to be quite low, i.e. something around about 9.5 to 10 million tonnes versus just over 16 million last year. And remembering that we've got the lowest wheat area in the ground for over 40 years. So we're not going to have much wheat around, but at least the early crops we're seeing are fairly good quality in terms of protein, Hagberg and specific weights. There is a little bit of variability in the protein levels, but I think we do tend to see that in most years, and hopefully that will settle down as the harvest progresses.
That's Farmers Weekly Deputy Arable Editor David Jones.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Hi, I'm Dan Lydiat. I'm a professional rugby player for the Ospreys and also a brand ambassador for Massey Ferguson. But my parents' farm is about 480 acres. It's based in Mid Wales. They run about 400 to 500 breeding ewes on there. And I've got my own small herd of pedigree Welsh black cattle. I've got an older brother there as well. Me and him together, we'd be fifth generation on the same family farm. When I'm buying machinery, I look for something that's fit for purpose and also that's going to last. The appeal of Massey Ferguson machinery is their build quality, the reliability, and when things do go wrong from time to time, their backup service is second to none. Farming's important to me because I grew up on a farm and I sort of instilled hard work into me from a young age, and that's transferred into my professional career as a rugby player and the tradition of farming. And it's something that I hope to carry on after I finish playing and hang up my boots and go back to it.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
A group of farmers in East Scotland have formed a discussion group to share their experience as they adopt min-till systems and cover crops to regenerate their soils. Ben Barron is one of the farmers involved, and I started by asking him how easy it was to give up the plough.
it's pretty hard. It's not as straightforward as just stopping ploughing one year and starting to direct drill or min-till or whatever the next year. That is physically what you do, but if you do it that way, there's a big time period for your soil to get itself in order. So you have a few years of some pretty wishy-washy crops. The other way of doing it is doing it very gradually over a number of years, either by switching one field at a time or by slowly but surely reducing the depth of your cultivation right down to nothing and ultimately direct drilling. I did the direct route because I knew I wanted to get the final point as quickly as possible. We went hard and fast with the cost savings, but the flip side of that is that you have some fairly reduced yields initially. But in reducing the input, I'm giving my soil the best opportunity to start to recover as quickly as possible.
It does require that leap of faith. How long did it take to start seeing results?
This harvest that we're about to start will be harvest number 5. I'm not there 100% yet. It does take time. But even with the reduced yields, the amount we were saving on inputs was offsetting that as well.
And how's it been working with other farmers in the discussion group? Does it make it more bearable?
Yes, it does. I'd gone through the worst of my conversion probably before we started the group. But when I started, really, there was very little in the way of other people who were doing this or help or assistance or advice. And coupled with that, other people poo-poo what you're doing as well, which is, it's fine, but you have to be pretty thick-skinned to put up with that prolonged periods of time. And things on your farm, doing it the way I do, didn't look particularly good for a few years. So these are all hurdles you have to overcome, and you have to be pretty thick-skinned to do that. So having these groups, it's definitely worth getting involved in one of them to give you that support.
Ross Mitchell, a berry and arable farmer at Castleton, has been trying different methods of establishing green cover crops.
So what we're doing is we built a broadcaster to broadcast cover crops into standing crop. It'll gain us 2 to 3 weeks of establishment and timing to get really good cover crops. We're then chopping the straw on top of the cover crop, so it gives it a bit of a mulch, and letting the cover crop come up, because what we've found is where there's been really good open rooted cover crops, the spring establishment is much better.
Previously, anything that was sort of harvested last week of August, we were then going in and putting a cover crop in behind that, but what we've found is it's just getting too late once you get towards September.
The project is being coordinated by Peter Lindsay from SAC Consulting, part of Scotland's Rural College. He says different farmers have different aims.
There's probably no one system that'll suit everybody, rather than just being dead set on doing, for example, no-till, but instead concentrating on reducing cultivations, whether it's moving from plough down to a tine drill with a leg in the ground rather than just a no-till drill. It's a step in the right direction, or whether it's cutting out ploughing down to, say, 1 year and three or something like that. We're moving towards getting the soil into better shape, better health. All farmers have got to make a living as well, so taking a huge risk and jumping in with 2 feet can be a big financial risk as well, but moving gradually towards it is less of a risk. So that's why this is quite a long project. To see the change over time, what works 1 year, for example, in the cover crops, don't necessarily grow the same the next year when it's a dry season. We're yet to see how this one pans out. It looked as if it was going to be an early season, but it's probably turning into a more normal season at the minute, with the potential to turn into a late season if it continues to rain much more. Everybody will learn from each other, particularly in this group. That's the benefit of it. They've all got different systems. They're all trying different things, and some have been in it longer than others, and basically trying to learn from each other's mistakes rather than everybody having to make the same mistake and learn from it themselves can hopefully speed up the process.
That's Peter Lindsay from SAC Consulting. So, Johan, it's great to see this sort of thing taking place north of the border.
Isn't it just a lot further south, where I live, for instance, on the Essex-Suffolk border? Min-till's been very much a thing for a number of years now. And to see it happening further north, where there are different challenges, the seasons are different, for example, there aren't the opportunities to get cover crops into the ground that there are down here. That is really interesting, and it's quite inspiring. And to see farmers working together to find a new way of working to achieve what they want to achieve is really good.
And to a degree, it's sort of a leap into the unknown a bit compared to what things were, how things were usually done. So I suppose having the discussion groups obviously very helpful for these farmers to share their failures and successes.
Well, that's exactly what Peter Lindsay was saying. Look, I'm a big fan of peer-to-peer learning, farmers learning from farmers, discussion groups, I think they're the way to go. They're a lot better, aren't they, than having somebody stand up in front of you and tell you what you should be doing. Learning from each other's mistakes, learning what works, what doesn't work, it speeds up the process too, you know, whether it's broadcasting a cover crop into a standing crop or changing the way that you cultivate the soil, moving gradually to a mid-till system or going hard and fast like Ben Barron said he did. It's all grist to the mill. It all adds to the knowledge base there, and it's that sense of all being in it together as well, which I think can spur people on.
Challenging but exciting times up there, I think.
I think things are challenging wherever you are in farming at the moment. You only have to look at this season, the season we're in now. It's been one of the most topsy-turvy seasons that anybody's ever experienced. But I think more than that, you know, wherever you are in the UK, we're all moving to a new farming policy. It might be slightly different depending on which country you are, but soil health, I think everywhere, is going to become increasingly important. And farmers are going to be rewarded and supported in a different way. And that means to say that soil health, improving the soil structure, improving the organic matter, etc., is going to be increasingly important. And not only that, from a policy point of view, it makes economic sense as well. As Ben Barron was saying, you know, he's reduced his output, yes, but he's also reduced his inputs tremendously. So overall, his margins have improved. So not only does it make environmental sense, make sense from a policy point of view, it makes economic sense too.
We look forward to seeing how they get on and how it goes.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, he isn't with us in person this week, but our regular co-host Hugh Broom has sent us this special report, a glimmer of hope for sheep producers looking for a fairer price for their wool.
Wool is sustainable, it's fire retardant, it's biodegradable, and it's the most efficient form of insulation. And that's according to a group of wool producers who've created an online petition to present to government. The 38 Degrees page is calling for the Chancellor to support wool in his new £2 billion home insulation grant, as well as to make it part of any government policy on insulation going forward.
John Burt, a retired businessman from Shropshire, started the campaign.
I just couldn't stand the thought of these beautiful fleeces being ploughed into the ground and finding out that the farmer was getting one quarter of what he was paying a shearer per fleece. And then the Chancellor announced the home insulation grants a couple of weeks ago. And I thought, well, why hadn't he made that concomitant on the use of wool as the insulation material?
Gordon Perrott is the chairman of Black Mountain Insulation.
Natural wool is more expensive than ordinary insulant because of all the processes it goes through. It's got to be scoured to get rid of the lanolin, then it's got to be cleaned to get rid of all the dirt that's in the coat, and then we treat it for online for moth resistance. Yeah, it's a bit more expensive, but most people who are environmentally conscious and who are installing the material love it, and they will pay the extra for it quite happily, and they're thrilled with the outcome.
And as well as house insulation, there are other ingenious uses of wool. Sally Phillips is the inventor of Chimney Sheep, a wool plug that you push up your chimney when the fire's not in use to use as a draft excluder. This year, she'll buy 22 tonnes of Herdwick wool.
We lose about 5% of household heat up a chimney when the fire's not lit and you've got the central heating on. Warm air is constantly being lost up the chimney, so it's a very simple plug made out of Herdwick wool on a handle, and it blocks the chimney and keeps the warm air in your home, and it, as a consequence, it cuts out a lot of other cold drafts, because the warm air escaping up the chimney pulls in cold air to replace it, and that's what causes the cold drafts around doors and windows that we notice.
Sally Phillips there from Chimney Sheep.
That's Hugh Broom reporting. There you go, Ed. Shove a sheep fleece up your chimney and you can keep yourself warm even when the fire's not on. Look, the cost of shearing and packing far outweighs the current value of wool, and that's a big problem.
It really is. But, you know, this government scheme is a glimmer of hope and a glimmer of light. I mean, this could be a game changer.
The current drawback for many people, of course, is the cost of wool insulation, which is twice that on average of current glass fibre products. So anything that we can do to make it more affordable to people while getting a fairer price for farmers has got to be a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, but wool is nicer to handle. I mean, it can absorb moisture up to 30% of its volume and it doesn't affect its suitability as an insulator. So, for example, in the autumn, as the air gets wetter, it would absorb that in your loft and then release it when the weather warms up in the spring.
The other thing is that wool insulation doesn't go floppy and flat after a time like synthetic insulation, and that's exactly the problem that we've got in our loft at home at the moment. Our synthetic insulation does need replacing, and when we do replace it, we'll have to throw it away. But wool insulation, you know, it's completely recyclable, so all is good.
That's it. And also, you know, given it's a one-off cost to insulate your loft, you could argue that paying a premium is not a big deal for such a great product.
All in all then, completely bonkers that we send so much wool abroad when we could use so much more of it here. And the best of luck to everybody supporting that petition. Right, that's it for this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast. That was episode 19. We've done 19 of these podcasts so far. Thanks for having us with you. It's great to have you with us too. You can email us at podcast@fwi.co.uk. Do get in touch with your thoughts, ideas and suggestions for stories that you'd like us to cover. Ed, thank you very much for co-hosting. I hope you enjoyed the experience. It's been great working with you and I'm sure you'll co-host again.
Absolutely. It's been a great experience and it's good to be on.
Next week, my co-host will be Farmers Weekly senior machinery reporter Ed Mowbray, which means we're bound to be covering some machinery stories. We'll also have our regular markets roundup and the latest harvest updates. Just time to say, do subscribe to us at wherever you listen to your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, where you can leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Google Podcasts and Stitcher, and of course, the Farmers Weekly website at fwi.co.uk. From the Farmers Weekly News Desk, I'm Johan Tasker.
And I'm Ed Henderson. Thanks for listening.